This is Fair Mormon Frameworks on the Mormon Faircast. The Fair Mormon Frameworks series seeks to present Latter-day Saints whose grasp or knowledge about a specific topic can help us consider different frameworks within the gospel that lead with faith. I am your host, Bill Real.
In today's episode, we sit down with Russell Stevenson, author of Black Mormon, The Story of Elijah Abels. In the church, we often talk about the priesthood ban prior to 1978, and there's always some confusion over how that ban began. So we go back to the first priesthood holder of African descent, Elijah Abels, and discuss his story with the author Russell Stevenson. Now on to my interview with Russell Stevenson.
Russell Stevenson, welcome to the podcast. How are you today?
I'm doing fantastic, Bill. How are you?
I'm doing great. We're grateful to have you on today. For my listeners who may not know, Russell Stevenson is the author of a book, Black Mormon, The Story of Elijah Abels. And it's an interesting story because in the church we talk a lot about priesthood and some of the back and forth of whether it was a doctrine or a policy. And we're grateful to have Russell Stevenson on today because he's going to share with us the story of Elijah Abel and help us perhaps place in perspective this story of this man who was one of, if not the first, person of African descent, a black man who received the priesthood. And so maybe, Russell, if you can just start us off, tell us a little bit about how long it took to do this work and the research that went into it.
Researching this book has been really an invigorating experience. I first discovered the documents necessary to write the book while I was working at the Church History Archives. I was doing some rather related but different work for the church, and I found some documents that no one had really seen before or used before. And I thought, it would be good to write an article on Elijah Abels, and it had been some time since anyone had written on him, so I decided to at least start out with an article. And then as I began to dive into the documents, I found that there was enough to merit an entirely new revisiting of his life and legacy. So I decided to start from the ground up. I looked into, his childhood. I looked into, his experiences teaching in Canada. And I saw a very different story than the one that I had been taught previously. Before, I'd seen Elijah Abels primarily as a token figure, a rather one-dimensional man, the person who was trying to stay in the church, but, he was constantly persecuted, constantly attacked, constantly criticized by both friends and foes alike. So I realized that wasn't really the Elijah Abels that surfaced from the documents.
Gotcha. Well, let's get started right into it. Would you mind sharing with us maybe some of the interesting points from his early life and his conversion to the church?
Certainly. So his early life is shrouded in mystery, and that's often the case for African Americans living in antebellum America. Oftentimes, you just don't have a lot of documentation. You might have the journal entry of a slave owner. You might see some references in the local newspaper. But documentation is quite limited. In fact, the only reason we can have a biography about Elijah Abels is because he joined the church. What we can say is that he was born in Western Maryland, and that the census numbers indicate he was likely a slave. Now, we don't know that with any degree of certainty. We just know that there were far more slaves than there were free blacks in the places where he could have been born, either Washington or Frederick counties. So,
gotcha.
While we can't nail that down, I do find, the runaway slave narrative to be an attractive one. And, if someone were to make a movie about it, I would say that they would not be amiss to portray it in that light. So Elijah Abels, he somehow makes it from Western Maryland to Cincinnati around the late 1820s, early 1830s. We know that he had a child at some point. Whether this was a child from a marriage or whether it was some other kind of union, we don't know. We just know that she did die as an infant or as a toddler. And in Cincinnati, he likely found his first taste of freedom. Cincinnati was renowned as being the vortex of the Underground Railroad. It was a pretty dangerous city for a free black man to live at that. anytime you have a border city, you have a strong pro-slavery contingent, even if it's technically in free territory. So when Elijah Abels was walking the streets of Cincinnati for the first time, he was in a pretty heated environment. Cincinnati is where Harriet Beecher was living at the time. She would eventually, marry her husband and then become Harriet Beecher Stowe, who would write Uncle Tom's Cabin. And it was in the Cincinnati, Northern Kentucky region where she was first exposed to the evils of slavery. That would inspire her to write some of the more powerful vignettes in Uncle Tom's Cabin.
So in regards to his conversion, when did he meet up with the church?
He first met a man by the name of Ezekiel Roberts in or around 1832. Ezekiel Roberts, he was a local man. He was not a missionary. He was just a blacksmith, a father of two, really a great member missionary story. And he really had not lived outside of that region at any point in his life. He was not a part of the main body of the saints. So somehow, some way, Elijah and Ezekiel meet up, and Elijah finds the Mormon message to be a pretty moving one. And given how the Mormons saw African Americans at this time, that doesn't really surprise me. You look at the Book of Mormon, and it says that the gospel is for black and white, bond and free. And in Western Missouri, you have Mormons like W.W. Phelps who are talking about the end of the slave trade and the end of slavery generally as being a wonderful event. So at this point in Mormon history, all the evidence suggests that Latter-day Saints were inclined to be racially inclusive.
So he joins the church, and you, which is kind of a neat story from what you say, that this guy who is the person sharing the gospel with him isn't even with the main portion of the saints. He's just kind of off on his own.
Yes, more or less. There was a small branch there that had been established by Lyman White the year earlier. But they had probably never met Joseph Smith or any of the main leaders. They were probably only exposed to the Book of Mormon and, whatever preaching Lyman White and others gave them.
So does he get ordained to the priesthood relatively quick after his membership, or how does the ordination come about?
He is not immediately ordained to the priesthood. He is not ordained until 1836, after he joins with the main body of the saints, which is interesting, given that there would have been some level of priesthood leadership in the Cincinnati region, so they would have been able to ordain Elijah to the priesthood, and yet they did not. The exact reasoning for that is unclear. It would not be until Elijah would meet Joseph Smith in person that he would receive ordination to the Melchizedek priesthood. So I think that speaks to an interesting limitation for blacks in the church at this time. While they were open to having blacks, and even open to having blacks as members of the priesthood, they weren't gung-ho about it. They weren't saying, okay, let's go, baptize all the blacks and give them all the priesthood. They hadn't really formed their policy at this point. In fact, it would take Joseph Smith to really push for this policy to be implemented.
So it's almost like you're saying that they almost need a special sanction from the prophet to say with this specific individual, go ahead and do that.
Excuse me. I believe that to be the case. And I'm not suggesting that, this is indicative of any kind of policy. I would say this is indicative of, the assumptions that many Latter-day Saints had accepted at that time. While they were generally friendly to the blacks, in fact, that would get them in some trouble in Missouri, they weren't quite ready to entrust them with any kind of authority. It would take Joseph Smith's sheer will to make that happen.
Gotcha. So, I guess I want to ask this. When he's ordained to the priesthood, in our mind today, we see priesthood as when you turn 12 years old, you get the Aaronic priesthood. When you turn 18 or 19, you get the Melchizedek priesthood. So, we see that in the priesthood that young men are ordained at age 12. They go through different offices in a certain order. At 18 or 19, we're ordained to the Melchizedek priesthood. Do we know with Elijah Abels whether he is ordained to the Aaronic or Melchizedek or what office?
We do. We have no documented evidence of him being ordained to the Aaronic priesthood, but we do have surefire evidence of him being ordained to the Melchizedek priesthood. We have his elder's certificate. It is in the church archives. Anybody can go there at any time and see it for themselves. So that's really not up for dispute at this point. And what's noteworthy about the timing of this ordination is it makes it clear that Joseph Smith was navigating a pretty difficult racial coalition within the church. Because, you know, on the one hand, you do have people who are, you know, fairly anti-slavery, you know, people like W.W. Phelps. You know, he was willing to prevaricate on certain things, but you know, at the end of the day, he had been an abolitionist. And on the other hand, you have, you know, people like Zebedee Coltrane and Abraham Smoot, who, you know, they are a lot more sympathetic to the slave system. In fact, Abraham Smoot himself would own two slaves. And to complicating matters further, you have the ghosts of Jackson County. You see, the Saints had been, you know, expelled from Jackson County in summer of 1833. And one of the primary reasons they were expelled from Jackson County was because of their friendliness towards the black population. You know, whatever their views were on priesthood or anything else to that end, they certainly did not see slavery as a good thing. And then when W.W. Phelps publicly says, you know, maybe some blacks can come into the state of Missouri and, you know, join with the body of the Saints, it sends the local press into a conniption. They basically assume that the Latter-day Saints are trying to racially integrate the population, and worse still, that they're promoting racial intermarriage. And that was the gravest of all sins. No respectable white person, north or south, east or west, would ever endorse interracial marriage. And these were the accusations that they were leveling against the Latter-day Saints. It would ultimately lead to them being, being refugees in western Missouri. And Joseph Smith was very aware of this. So what Joseph Smith does is, in March of 1836, he ordains Elijah Abels to the priesthood, but then the next month, he writes an editorial for the Messenger and Advocate. And in this, he lays out every standard Southern argument for slavery and endorses it, upholds it, celebrates it, says that slavery is indeed ordained of God, and that anyone who says otherwise is clearly unfamiliar with the real situation that Southerners face. He says that blacks are morally decrepit, that they're, you know, a really dangerous class of people. And this is all within a month of his ordaining Elijah Abels.
So we like to paint Joseph or other leaders kind of being one side of an issue or another, but realizing that at this time in our country that there was a lot of tension over this, over slavery and over the issue that revolved around their freedoms, the abilities that they had to do things, their being considered property. And so Joseph is having a hard time kind of navigating this issue too, it seems.
Yes, that's the impression that comes from the documents. A couple months after Elijah Abels was ordination, Governor Daniel Dunklin of Missouri sent a letter to W.W. Phelps and said, listen, you all have been accused of being abolitionists. And, you know, just to be clear, being an abolitionist meant that you weren't just anti-slavery, but that you wanted to end slavery immediately. And that was seen as a radical position. It was akin to being a terrorist. You know, you didn't just want slavery to end. You were the kind of person who would sneak into black communities and stir up trouble. So Governor Dunklin says, if you Mormons don't want to be seen as abolitionists, well, then it's up to you. The burden is on you to prove your innocence. And
gotcha.
This was not just an abstract debate. This was the kind of thing that had caused, you know, the Latter-day Saints to be kicked from Jackson County. It could mean lives. So Joseph Smith was indeed put in a very difficult position. And on the one hand, he supported men like Elijah Abels. His friendship with Elijah Abels would last generations, or at least the memory of his friendship with Elijah Abels would last for generations. Even in the 20th century, people would be remembering how close Joseph and Elijah were. But at the same time, he could not allow Jackson County to happen again.
Right. No, that's fully understandable. All right, so Elijah Abels is ordained to the priesthood. He's ordained to the office of elder, correct?
Correct.
Okay. And so what happens to Elijah Abel after this? Where does he go?
So he's, at this point, he has joined with the main body of the Saints in Kirtland. And as often happens, shortly after you receive the Melchizedek priesthood, you are called on a mission. Now, we have no hard evidence of his being called, but we do know where he was called, and we do know something of what he was doing when he was serving there. In summer of 1838, spring summer, he served in Ontario, Canada. Now, the location is significant here. You know, sometimes you might say, okay, you know, one mission is basically the same as another. But in this case, Ontario, it would have had the interesting ramifications for Elijah Abels, because this was the leading site for runaway slaves in North America. And this was kind of seen as, you know, the Holy Land. If you could make it to Ontario, then you really couldn't hope for much better if you were a runaway slave. The slave community, or the runaway slave communities there, they often talk about how good it was, how this was really a place for any black person to go in and make good for themselves. And we know that Elijah Abels was there from, you know, quite a few sources. You know, Andrew Jensen, in his biographical encyclopedia, he identifies Ontario as Elijah Abels' mission site. We also have contemporary correspondence that talks about the preaching of a black missionary affiliated with the Mormons. And it gives us a pretty vivid description of the kinds of things that this black missionary was called upon to do. So what you have here is you have on the leading site for black runaway slaves, you have a pretty proof positive evidence that Elijah Abels was serving there. And furthermore, you have Joseph Smith, who is fearful of what could happen to blacks if they were to be living in Missouri. I mean, it was written in the law that no free black or mulatto, as they were called, the biracial African Americans, would be allowed into Missouri. So what I postulate, and this isn't something that we can definitively prove, but I think circumstantial evidence is friendly towards its interpretation, I postulate that Ontario was potentially a site for a black Mormon congregation. And Joseph Smith sent Elijah Abels there to maybe feel out prospects for establishing the church within the black community in Ontario. You know, we can't have them in the gathering place. We can't have blacks gather to the real Zion, but maybe we can have them in a safer locale in Ontario, Canada, where slavery is illegal and blacks can do well for themselves.
That makes sense. Do we have any feedback from source material that tells us how successful a mission that he had?
You know, we do have some evidence. There was a woman by the name of Eunice Ross, and later in life she wrote letters discussing some of his missionary activities. And the storyline that comes to us is that he was a tremendous preacher. He was very charismatic. She said that she had never heard a gospel sermon like that in her life. Yet he was illiterate. So he wasn't very polished. He wasn't the kind of person who could, fascinate you with great turns of phrases. But, the mere power of his testimony was enough to eventually convert Eunice Ross to the Mormon faith. That being said, though, he did have a pretty difficult time. First of all, Canada was on the verge of civil war, and this is one of those stories that really gets left out of American history, even though it did have implications for American foreign policy at the time. So we don't often talk about the foreign policy of Canada and the United States generally, but in Elijah Abels' case, this had real and immediate consequences. You see, there was a clique of pro-American rebels in Ontario, Canada, at that time, that wanted to ally Ontario with the United States. Now, Ontario was still under British rule, so they weren't about to let that happen. Elijah Abels walks into Canada in the middle of all this. So what you have is you have Elijah Abels, who is one black, two an American, and three a Mormon. All three identities are working against him. And it's not long before rumors begin to be circulated that Elijah Abels was involved in some foul play, that he'd been involved in the murder of a family. Now, there's no evidence that this is actually the case, but these kinds of accusations are being leveled against Mormons throughout the region, and largely because of their, affiliation with an American religion. It didn't help that they kept talking about this great gathering place in western Missouri. So their theology is American, and, some of them, at least, they had American connections. So Elijah Abels had to negotiate a pretty tense political situation, and he himself would be the target of mob attack. On one occasion, they chased him through the woods, and eventually he made his way to a Mormon household, and it looked like they were going to tar and feather him. And then the housewife comes out and opens fire on the mob. It's a pretty colorful image that that this correspondence presents before us. It does tell us, though, that white Latter-day Saints, they felt an obligation to protect their black brother, even by force.
Cool. Do we know how long he served his mission for?
What we know is that it wasn't very long. He was out of Canada by September, early October 1838. And Eunice talked about him arriving in April or so. So I would say it was less than a year, probably something on the order of 5 to 6 months.
Gotcha. Well, so he ends his mission. What do we know about the rest of his life?
You know, we know a lot about the rest of his life, and, you know, we could talk for hours and hours about this, but, you know, just a couple of the highlights. He eventually makes his way to Nauvoo. He works as an undertaker there. He also serves on a rescue squad to save Joseph Smith from a kidnapping attempt. Later on, he moves to Cincinnati, and this is, he moves back to Cincinnati, and this is probably the most important period in his life, because this is when he has a position of authority, and he is living quite a ways away from the Latter-day Saints. So the fact, you know, how he handles himself when given power, I think reveals a lot about his character. The next evidence that we have of his activities in Cincinnati, it comes up in 1845 after the death of Joseph Smith. Now, I've mentioned before that Joseph and Elijah were very close friends. You could argue that, well, maybe the only reason Elijah stayed in the church at all was because of Joseph Smith. But the evidence that we have tells us a different story. Joseph is dead. There is, you know, the succession crisis, you know, a lot of infighting between the Quorum of the 12 Apostles, Sidney Rigdon, James Strang. They're all fighting for the mantle of Joseph. Now, you could imagine that if Elijah really had only converted for Joseph Smith, that either one, he would have defected at this point. Hey, you know, this isn't for me. You know, my friend Joseph is dead. And frankly, some of you have treated me pretty badly. But he doesn't do that. Instead, he actually cracks down on dissent in favor of the 12. Like when some women begin criticizing the Quorum of the 12, he says, we can't have this. And he calls for their excommunication. And that excommunication is promptly executed.
Do we know anything about what year he died and perhaps how his death came about?
You know, he died in 1884, and you know, he basically died of old age. It is interesting that he died only a few weeks after, you know, serving a mission to again to Cincinnati. By this point, his wife had died. He was living, you know, as a lone man and a renter in, you know, in some member's house. He was entirely alienated from his family. But yet he was still willing to serve a mission in the closing days of his life. And that mission probably cost him his life.
Was he ever called upon in any kind of leadership positions within the church or certain callings or anything like that that we know of
during
his life?
But in 1839, in December of 1836, we know that he was a 70 because his name appears on a roll for the first council of the 70.
Wow.
So at this point, you know, he was entrusted with a relative degree of authority, and he, you know, he obviously exercised that when he was living in Cincinnati.
Gotcha. So let's move into another area. Let's talk a little bit about the origins of the priesthood ban from your perspective and your research with Elijah Abels, and maybe if you want to share with me some prominent figures, and obviously Joseph Smith will play into this, but how we got to a point where we had a policy where those with black skin from African descent couldn't have the priesthood.
And that's a really important question, and I'm glad you asked it. So, you know, as I've discussed earlier, Joseph Smith, he basically supported an inclusive policy, even if he engaged in, you know, some level of racial politics, you know, out of self-preservation. The origins of the priesthood ban itself date to a time period between 1847 and 1849. So, you know, we have in spring of 1846, the Latter-day Saints, they leave Nauvoo, and it appears that they're going to go to the west, you know, either to, you know, California or the Great Basin or maybe the Northwest. It's not entirely certain at this point. They settle in winter quarters. Now, I think it's important to understand how they saw themselves, and I think it's a useful tool for how we can understand, you know, the evolution of the race policy. They saw themselves as Israel. Now, in Old Testament times, Israel was not immune from collective sin. In fact, quite the contrary. They often were chastised for collectively sinning in a variety of different ways. The most famous of them being the building of the golden calf in the wilderness, and that caused Israel to wander for some 40 years. I don't think that 19th century Mormons are that much different from ancient Israel in that regard either. So they're in winter quarters, and a mysterious African-American man by the name of William McCary joins their midst. He had been baptized and presumably had been ordained to the priesthood. He had married a white Latter-day Saint woman by the name of Lucy Stanton. Her father was a prominent Latter-day Saint. He had been a stake president, and he was a widely known figure within Latter-day Saint circles. So here you have this prominent white woman marrying a black man, and it scandalized the Winter Quarters community. They couldn't believe that Lucy Stanton would ever do something so depraved. And as I mentioned earlier, this was really a line that nobody dare cross. And whether you're northern or southern, this is the kind that a thing that at your kindest you made jokes about this, and at worst it would probably cost some people their lives. So immediately the Mormons began hurling racial epithets at William McCary and his wife Lucy. They use the N-word quite freely, and it's pretty offensive to them. So William McCary and Lucy approach Brigham Young as well as several apostles, and they say, "Brother Brigham, what do you have to say about this? They keep saying these things about us, and it's wrong." And you know what Brother Brigham says? Mind you, he's looking at Lucy and William in the eyes. He's looking at racial intermarriage, this sin of sins, and he doesn't even glance at it. In fact, he says, "You know what? Your color does not matter. Your skin doesn't matter. We are all of one flesh." In fact, he says, "One of our best elders is, a black man living in Massachusetts." He was referring to Walker Lewis. So, in March of 1847, Brigham Young, he would have opposed a priesthood ban. Now, what ends up happening is Brigham Young leaves Nauvoo, goes out west, to settle, this is the place and all that. But while Brigham Young is out west, William McCary implements a form of racial intermarriage. And it's, to make matters worse, it's plural marriage. And he does this with several of the women there. He's a very charismatic man. He knew how to charm women. And some of these women were married. You can imagine it doesn't take too long before he is run out of town on a rail and his wife is sent in tow. So the leaders who had given William McCary any kind of standing in the church, they come under quite a bit of pressure. They're accusing Orson Hyde of of giving a horrible creature like William McCary this kind of authority. And it is within this context that you have the very first comment connecting skin color to a priesthood ban. Parley P. Pratt stands up and tells everyone, this is an awful man. How could you dare follow him? How could you dare listen to him? A man like him with the blood of Ham has no right to the priesthood. This is the first evidence of there being any kind of connection between skin color and an exclusionary policy as regards to race.
Do we get any feel, obviously you're saying that's the first time, but yet it doesn't take long after this for it to become a pretty solid policy. Do we get any feel that Joseph Smith on some level, Brigham Young on some level, were teaching this or preparing for it or figuring their way through it and this was still an option on the table? Or is it this kind of, these events here, that you're speaking of that just kind of put this into motion?
I'll have to actually address the first part of your comment first. You say that it didn't take long for this policy to become hard and fast. I would actually suggest that my research problematizes that narrative somewhat. So by 1849, Brigham Young had made it clear that he did not want blacks holding the priesthood. Now, there were some events that led to that, and it's clear that he was going through a pretty significant internal struggle over this. On the one hand, he wanted to give blacks the priesthood, but on the other hand, he did have some latent racial sentiments that he had inherited from his upbringing, and it didn't take much for him to snap, as it were. That being said, though, in spite of Brigham Young's views, we know that as late as 1861, the race policy, as we refer to it, was not really rooted within the Mormon populace. And the reason we know that is that there's a letter from a man living in Parowan, and he gives us a first-hand account of, what it means to have African ancestry in an outlying community. He goes around asking church leaders, listen, I have African ancestry. What does this mean? Can I hold the priesthood or can't I? And none of them seem to know the answer. In fact, one of them says, hey, this is a new thing to me. I've never heard of this. So, well, I think he may have been going a little bit far. I think he was maybe covering his tracks a little bit. And he wanted to, you know, give himself the best possible image in this letter. On the other hand, I do think it does speak to the degree to which the race policy had sunk in. There was a sense that there was something wrong with it. It was something that you might even get mocked over. But it was not solidified even as late as 1861. In fact, no official decisions would be made until the late 1870s as regards to blacks having priesthood.
Do we have a date on the latest ordination to take place before the ban is pretty much across the board?
We don't have an exact date, but that would be William McCary. We know that Orson Hyde ordained him. So that would be around 1846, 1847. There had been another man in Massachusetts, and his name is Walker Lewis, and he had been ordained in the early 1840s.
Gotcha. What is the church's relations? I mean, we talk about the relationship with blacks. What's their relationship with Native Americans at the time? Maybe other ethnicities such as Polynesians. What is the church doing in regards to priesthood with these other cultural groups?
Yeah, and that's an important comparison to make because it gives us some insight into Mormonism's racial worldview. So the Mormons' relationship with Native Americans, it was seen as a paternal relationship. You see, the Book of Mormon, it was widely understood to be a text about the history of the American Indian. And it talks about how, you know, the Lamanites are a chosen people and how they have tremendous promise, even if, you know, the generations of sinfulness and depravity have, you know, drugged them back down to, you know, their savage state. So the Latter-day Saints, they looked upon the quote-unquote Lamanite population fondly. You know, they thought that the Indians would indeed inherit the land of Missouri. And you see that at least for the first couple generations of the Mormon experience. In 1850, Brigham Young sends a letter to Latter-day Saints in Utah Valley saying, hey, listen, you need to be kinder to the local Indians. You need to extend some sympathy to them. If they kill you, understand that the reason they're doing it is because they're savages, and that's what they've been taught to do. So while that's incredibly condescending, it is a call for some kind of moderation. Polynesians, same story. We have, you know, evidence from missionaries who are serving in the Polynesian islands where they're talking about, you know, Hawaiians and Tahitians in the same kind of light that they're talking about Native Americans.
Gotcha. Let's work towards kind of wrapping up and maybe give you a chance to share a few final thoughts, and then I want to talk a little bit about the book as a whole.
Sure.
So we have the priesthood giving to Elijah Abels. We have it being given to other folks of African descent, brethren of African descent within the church. We know the ban comes into place. We see that it's not a cut and dry thing, that there's a lot of issues surrounding it and perhaps why this policy goes into place. What are we to take away from this now that we fast forward to 1978 and all worthy males are able to receive the priesthood, and kind of looking back at a reflection of this whole journey, what kind of understanding should we gather from all this information that would help us better see this issue?
Yeah, I think that the recent addition to Official Declaration Number 2 really speaks to this. The Church Scriptures Division has recently edited the heading to Official Declaration Number 2, and in it acknowledges that at one point in Latter-day Saint history, African-American men were occasionally ordained to the priesthood. And then in that heading, it says that church records offer no clear insight as to why this practice was terminated. So the church is making clear that Official Declaration Number 2 was, in some ways, an effort to revert to the past. It wasn't a new thing. If anything, it was a very old thing. It was saying, hey, listen, we got it right in the beginning. Let's, you know, get back to how we began. So for me, the big story of Elijah Abels, and the major moral takeaway, if that's what a person is interested in, certainly the believing Latter-day Saint would be, is that, you know, this priesthood ban was not ingrained in the Mormon experience. It was not a necessary part of Mormonism. Rather, it was an unfortunate and wrong-headed cultural adaptation. I often compare it to the Israelites wandering in the wilderness. Why did they wander in the wilderness? Well, it was because they erected a golden calf. Well, the Latter-day Saints ended up erecting a god of whiteness. And by the end of the 19th century, Latter-day Saints are talking about Utah as being a white refuge, as being a place that white people can go to without fear of, you know, marrying into lines of African descent. So the Mormons, they got it right to begin with. And then they deviated from the path that Joseph Smith had essentially established for them.
I guess I want to go back maybe to the PBS interview where Elder Holland was interviewed. And he was asked point blank about how he would respond to the fact that early leaders in the church, Mark E. Peterson, Elder Bruce R. McConkie, and President Brigham Young, and some of the things they said, and there's others too, I get that, but I think those are the three that are picked on the most. And he essentially said that those brethren, unfortunately, tried to give shape to a policy and probably would have been better off not saying anything at all. And it sounds like very much to what you're speaking about, which is we got away from the truth for a while. And it almost sounds like you're speaking to this idea of a collective sin and something that we as a people had to repent over before the Lord was ready to say, okay, now they're ready, let's put it back the way it should have been.
You know, I don't think you're far off on that. I mean, in the early 20th century, it's clear that the Latter-day Saints had begun to use whiteness as a way of identifying themselves, certainly within the Mormon corridor. I've done some research on the history of Mormon dance, and you find that in the 1950s dance manuals, that the writers of the manuals are specifically telling youth not to dance to Jitterbug, because essentially it was too closely associated with the African-American community. It was widely known as a black dance. And, you know, we also have a BYU professor named Alma Heaton. You know, he instituted the first dance classes into Brigham Young University. And he was specifically commissioned to teach the kids how to dance in a civilized way, how to dance in a refined way. And he said, you know, this rock and roll business is actually going to eventually bring us back to the days of the African stomp dance. So whiteness was something that Latter-day Saints were actively trying to cultivate in the early 20th century. And there are some complex reasons for that. But for our discussion, I think what's worth noting is that the Latter-day Saints are capable of adopting the views of their, you know, of outsider communities. We are a porous people. We like to think of ourselves as, you know, this isolated mountain people who've been living, you know, in the mountains and removed from everybody. And that was what they were trying to do. But even though they didn't entirely realize it, they had absorbed the racial prejudices of those that surrounded them. And only a very few people like Joseph Smith were committed to enabling blacks receiving the priesthood at all.
Interesting. You know, my wife and I have taken ballroom dancing lessons, and the Jitterbug is one of our favorites. So now I've got a story to share with that.
When
somebody asks me about it. I want to conclude with this question, and then we'll talk a little bit about the book and where people can find it. Let me start off this way. Brant Gardner, who I'm sure you're familiar with.
Yes.
Has written a lot about the translation of the Book of Mormon, and one of his little pet theories that I think has gotten some attention is his looking at the Book of Mormon and looking at every instance where color is mentioned, a skin of blackness or a dark skin, and he's related it to a spiritual darkness, not at all related to their skin color. And when you were talking there the last few minutes, it reminded me of his commentary, because essentially what you're saying is that we as a people put too much focus on skin color, even in the church, and in a sense got away from what Heavenly Father intended, how we should treat each other. Mm-hmm. And what are your thoughts on Brant Gardner's theory? Is that a position you take as well?
My particular position, I mean, I think it's an interesting position, and it could well be true. I think one that is more rooted in the historical experience of the Book of Mormon peoples, and again, this is assuming that they were indeed actual populations, is that the Nephites were just as capable of racism as any other population. And the Book of Mormon is, at the end of the day, primarily a Nephite text. And, you know, I've I've had some very good conversations with good scholars on this. Max Mueller is the one that comes to mind, and I need to give him really full credit for this particular insight, but it's one that people need to hear. He argues that, you know, Samuel the Lamanite, he provides us the best insight into Mormon race out of the entire text. Because here you have Samuel the Lamanite, who is clearly part of the racial other. You know, he's a Lamanite, he's depraved, he is backsliding. He preaches to the Nephites, and somehow his words disappear. Then when Jesus Christ comes, he says, well, where are the words of my servant Samuel the Lamanite and all these presumably white-ish or comparatively white Nephites? They say to themselves, well, we don't know. Where are they? What happened to them? They somehow escaped the narrative. And Jesus Christ has to specifically tell the Nephite archivist to include the words of Samuel the Lamanite, and they have to go dig them up, and eventually they're integrated into the narrative. So here you have, Jesus Christ personally intervening to include the voices of minorities. And that's my particular take on, you know, on the Book of Mormon text as a historical document. I don't think in any way denies Brant Gardner's thesis. I think it's a compliment to it.
Gotcha. You know, it is interesting. It almost seems to speak to the fact that we as a people always seem to struggle with those of different color or different cultures, mm-hmm. and really fail to grasp the whole idea that God has sent each of his children here to work out their salvation, and for us to each be brothers and sisters in the gospel, whether in the church or out of the church, and to serve each other and to help each other to move towards Christ.
Definitely. I absolutely agree with that. And you know, one other point I would like to make, in it regards to, you know, how the Mormon people have collectively, you know, absorbed the sin of racism. It's very tempting for us to, you know, go and catalog all the comments by church leaders and say, or, you know, look at how racist they were, you know, they were oppressing people of color. And all of that is true, by the way. I mean, Brigham Young himself supported slavery in Utah, and eventually slavery would be passed. Utah was a slave territory. That being said, though, I think by focusing exclusively on them, it deflects blame from us. You say, see, it's their fault. No, our people were not racist on their own accord. They were just racist because their leaders told them to be.
When in reality, it's the opposite.
Yes. If you look in 1847, for example, Brigham Young was the one who was saying, you know, skin color doesn't matter, while ordinary saints were the ones saying, oh, yes, it does. So I would say that Brigham Young was more of an indicator of where the Mormon people were, not always a leader when it came to race policy.
Gotcha. Right. Those are not men that are completely separate from the rest of us in the culture of church membership. In other words, it was more of a reflection of where we all kind of were at that time.
Yes. And I think that, you know, that kind of approach, it not only is it more historically nuanced, but it also places a responsibility on the Mormon people to change the culture if they don't like it.
Right. Yep. Beautiful. One more question that I just was reminded of, and maybe this will just tie us back into the whole purpose of the podcast, but this is an issue of people who have a faith crisis or ponder or even do leave the church are asked to list their top issues. One of them is this ban of priesthood, the policy, the history behind it. And I would simply ask you, do you see any reason why somebody has to leave a church over this issue?
You know, I would be lying if I said this issue didn't trouble me. I mean, I wrote a book about it. So obviously it's going to weigh pretty heavily on my mind. And, you know, the most recent evidence of this is, you know, Hans Mattsson. He was the Area Authority 70 in Sweden, who he's publicly made known his doubt and his concern about the historicity of church claims and various historical issues. You know, he has not left the church, at least at this point, but he's made it clear that there is a lot that rests on his mind, and he's been quite public about it too. You can even see it on the New York Times. So my perspective on this is that it is right for people to be troubled by this. And it's clear that Elder Holland himself is troubled by this. You know, it's clear that the church, church leadership is troubled by this, by, you know, the addition of the official declaration's new heading. And if it didn't trouble them, then they wouldn't really address it. So anyone who were to come to me and say, hey, Russell, I'm really worried. Like, how could we as a people do this? I would sympathize with them. I would say, yeah, indeed. How could we as a people do this? How could we as a people ever possibly allow slavery to exist in our midst as it did in the 1850s and early 1860s? As to whether a person should leave the church or not, my general answer to that is I have yet to find anything in Mormon history that is fundamentally worse than what existed in American society. You know, at the time, the Mormons' worst problems were because they were raised with American values of the 19th century. So right. That's my general answer. I'm not inclined to tell anyone, okay, should you leave, shouldn't you leave? But I can say that their crime was being too American.
Thank you for listening to the Mormon Faircast. If there is an issue that you've been wondering about, you can often find the latest answers at the Fair Mormon Wiki, found at fairmormon.org. If you can't find your answer there, feel free to pose your question to the Fair Mormon Apologist by visiting the Fair Mormon contact page. Questions or comments about this episode can be sent to podcast@fairlds.org or join the conversation at fairblog.org. Tell your friends about us and help us increase the popularity of this podcast by subscribing in iTunes and by writing a review. Music for this episode was provided courtesy of Chris Rice. The opinions expressed in the podcast are not necessarily the views of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints or of Fair Mormon.
Come thou fount of every blessing, tune my heart to sing thy grace. Streams of mercy never ceasing, call for songs of loudest praise. Teach me some melodious sonnet, sung by flaming tongues above. Praise the mount, I'm fixed upon it, mount of thy redeeming love. Here I raise my Ebenezer, here by thy great help I've come, and I hope by thy good pleasure safely to arrive at home. Jesus sought me when a stranger, wandering from the fold of God. He to rescue me from danger interposed his precious blood. Oh, that day when freed from sinning, I shall see thy lovely face. Clothed then in blood-washed linen, how I'll sing thy sovereign grace. Come, my Lord, no longer tarry, take my ransomed soul away. Send thine angels now to carry me to realms of endless day. Oh, to grace, how great a debtor daily I am constrained to be. Let thy goodness, like a fetter, bind my wandering heart to thee. Prone to wander, Lord, I feel it, prone to leave the God I love. Here's my heart, oh, take and seal it. Seal it for thy courts above. Here's my heart, oh, take and seal it. Seal it for thy courts above.